And now, I mean, if you're sending weapons to Ukraine, I'm not sure if there is any possibility to discriminate who are these weapons are getting to. And the problem with Russia invasion is that one of the results would be that the people like Azov would get probably even more power and even more notoriety for playing some role in this war, specifically in the defense of Mariupol. And yeah, the result would be not great.
Are you concerned about this?
I mean, there are many things that you should be concerned right now, and not. I mean, Azov is just one of the many other things that. I mean, most of Ukrainians are primarily concerned now about the shellings and bombings and rockets that may strike their homes and kill them.
Volodymyr Shenko, we want to thank you for being with us. We want to ask you to stay with us so we can do a post show and post online at democracynow.org. Volodymyr is a Ukrainian sociologist, research associate at the Institute for East European Studies at the Free University of Berlin. Democracy Now! Has an immediate opening for a news writer producer. Visit democracynow.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Good morning, everybody. Something's going on. Good morning. Am I working? Huh. I can't hear me. Okay. Get any levels tight. Are we on? Hello? There we go. I had to just repress the button. Sorry, everybody. little technical glitch there here on our soundboard in production 2, but a click of the button solved it. Anyway, I'm Paul Roland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and war is absolutely good for nothing, and it's really disgusting. And it's exactly what the world didn't need right now in Ukraine or anywhere. Yemen or Palestine or Somalia or Ethiopia or anywhere. It's just wrecking lives and ruining families and sending people to the grave. But what the heck can we do about it right here in the heart of the empire? Anyway, so we started out with the Frankie Goes to Hollywood's version of War. I didn't even know that existed. I know well the Edwin Starr version from 1970 because I heard that on the radio a lot. That was a very gutsy move there, Edwin Starr doing that anti-war song at the height of the Vietnam War from his album War and Peace. A bit of a rawer, guttier version, but hey, I just wanted to give you a taste of that other one. So we're going to be continuing our discussion of last week. If people want to talk about other things, I guess I'll entertain that possibility. But I thought Ron Jacobs brought up some really important discussions. I know there's been a lot of conversation on KBOO and elsewhere, not in the major media, not a whole lot of critique of how the U.S. helped set the stage for the war in Ukraine. Because, you know, once a war gets going that, you know, we're on one side or the other, the corporate media tends to jump on the bandwagon in a fairly disgusting way and sort of, you know, not have a lot of historical perspective. We try to bring a little more of that here to the extent possible. So we're going to be talking about U.S. hypocrisy and, which is on full display both in the coverage of the war and also in the Supreme Court confirmation hearings going on right now. And they call it political grandstanding, but it's these deep-seated, call it culture wars, history wars, war over the, you know, the real underlying truth of what made this country so powerful and so hypocritical, including, of course, the legacy of slavery, the legacy of colonization. And we are all children of empire. This isn't just old history. This is a current history. Number of U.S. bases around the world, the Cold War policies of dampening anti-colonial, liberation movements in the so-called Third World, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the legacy that we have to somehow break in order to even begin to address the most pressing of our problems, which are extreme inequality, climate change, general environmental devastation, white supremacy and racism, etc. So I would like to open up the phone lines right away. I'm going flying solo today, so I could use your help. Looking for people who haven't called in before. I know just like a relatively small percentage of people who actually listen to KBOO are financial contributors. Which is okay, but we do depend on those contributions. I'd like to think of all those people who did contribute during our winter membership drive to keep us on the air. Also, a relatively small percentage of the people who actually listen to these talk shows actually call up and get on the air. I know it's not that easy a thing to do. I actually get really nervous when I'm calling up to any talk show. I don't do it all that often. I've done it to a few of those right-wing AM shows, and I always surprise myself how nervous I get, because you're going on the air, people are going to listen to you, I can understand that. So just pretend like you're just talking to me as an individual. Anyway, the number is 503-231-8187. I would like to hear from people who don't ordinarily call in. Just like to hear new voices, kind of give people, some people might feel, if someone else calls in, it kind of dissuades you from calling in yourself. You're like, oh, maybe they, have something more important to say. But I really would like to hear from people who may be a little shyer for whatever reason, so just maybe people who do call in more regularly, kind of step back. Give people a chance. 503-231-8187. That's the number, 503-231-8187. So, yeah, this, it's, you know, war does a bunch of things. You know, it's sort of a watershed line in some ways. You know, if you're, you know, I actually sometimes have that feeling of like, oh yeah, we need to just you know, we need just to deploy more, you know, more weapons and just get this thing over with. We need, you know, we need to rise up and support the Ukrainians and defeat the bad Russians. You know, there is a tendency, you know, to sort of fall into the allure of war. You know, just like if you read about accounts of, you know, on the battlefield itself, the really terrible attraction of that experience, that it's just, there's so much excitement, there's so much, it's just the adrenaline, it just pulls the adrenaline, and then the comradeship that people talk about on the battlefield, because, you know, your life or death depends on it. I think there's something to that in more general society that is at play, and it's hard to resist. It's probably why, you know, and of course the corporate media, you know, is, you know, just generally, you know, doesn't want to go against the so-called national interest and all that. So yeah, I admire people who stand up, you know, especially soldiers who refuse to fight. You know, I'm not saying that the Ukrainians should refuse to fight. It's a terrible dilemma, because obviously, if you're attacked, and, you know, if whatever set the stage for the war, to whatever extent it was the NATO expansion had a role in it, to what extent, you know, provocation of Putin, to what extent Putin being the product of, you know, wherever he comes from and his own imperial ambitions, whatever it is, once the war gets going, it either have to fight it out, or you have to come to negotiation. And negotiation is hard, because there's a certain element of it, either admitting that you're wrong, or, you know, lowering your expectations or your sights. So anyway, it's a terrible situation all around, but I think hopefully all of us would agree that negotiation is the best way to go, especially if you see that just the absolute devastation happening to some of the cities in Ukraine right now, which is just terrifying to think, to be living under that. Anyway, I apparently did spark some real interest right away, which is good. So let's we got Jeff, John, and Ronald. Jeff is first up. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's very difficult for us to have a conversation in America, because we're all in a type of bunker mentality or a tribalism. And I think we need to address that problem. And I think that problem is brought about in part, or to a great degree, by the media. And I think our focus should be to bringing the people together. And I believe it can be done, but it would take a lot of work.
Well, I guess the question is, since you bring up bunker mentality and tribalism, I have some issues with the term tribalism, which I'll get into later, but you bring those up and you say we need to bring people together, since those are things that seemingly keep people apart. So I guess the question is, on whose terms, or on what terms are people going to be brought together?
Under the sovereignty and self-determination of the people.
Sovereignty and self-determination of the people. Okay. So basically you're saying that you can not ignore, but somehow you can resolve these longstanding legacies of white supremacy, racism, colonialism, sexism, and others that are seemingly embedded in our cultures. Somehow they can all be somehow resolved under the banner of self-determination and sovereignty?
Yes.
How is that?
By having multiculturalism.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's
by allowing each community to have its own culture.
Each community I seem to have gone dead again.
I'm not hearing you.
I don't know.
Hello?
Hello. Okay. There's something going on with this board here. I don't know what it is. Somewhere there's a glitch in our system. Hopefully this doesn't keep happening. Anyway, okay. Well, I mean, yeah, those are all, sure, I can agree with that. I guess the problem is it's not really happening. So what concrete steps are we going to do to make it happen?
Well,
and besides, I don't know about this idea of separate communities. Are you talking about like, how are these different communities? So are you talking about like separate but equal, like separating African Americans from European Americans? I don't understand.
I am suggesting that the people define community for themselves.
But communities are all mixed up and you know, intermarried and interliving together, and
that's right.
And that, is that a problem?
No.
Okay.
People will be able, if people are sovereign, then they will be able to define community for themselves.
Okay. Well, so how does that work on a practical level when you've got, you know, you've got housing policies that continue to discriminate against African Americans? You've got, you know, you've got policing systems, you've got mass incarceration. So how do you deal with those issues, which seem to be going against this dream of a self-determining multicultural society?
If you have a culture in which, you know, if you have multiculturals and or if people are able to create their own cultures.
Right, but I'm saying there's forces that are against that. So how do you deal with those forces that are against that? Entrenched policing systems. There's entrenched prison system. There's entrenched, problems around the recognition of native treaties and sovereignty. There's structural impediments that go against this nice ideal that you're espousing.
Once people redefine communities,
okay,
then they can decide.
I'm sorry. This is just too abstract for me. I'm talking about the concrete realities that are structural impediments to
it's
your.
It's not abstract.
Okay. Well,
abstract.
What step right now would you take to make that happen?
Restore the Constitutional Republic.
Okay, I see where you're going. Well, we're going to let that sit and see what John has to say. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for your show, and thanks for the topic. It's a big one. I think what I'll do is quote a couple of spiritual leaders, and I won't even bother saying who it came from, but you'll probably figure out one of them at least. One came from a teacher who came from India to the West, and he was falsely accused and actually found guilty of his so-called crime. The crime was doing something with the women that were attending his meditation classes. And there was no specifics. It was just this long-haired, dark-skinned foreigner must have done something with our women while we were busy working. And so it was all jealousy-based. And he was found guilty. And his reaction to the press when they asked him was just popped out of his mouth, I think. Maybe he shouldn't have even said this, but he was honest. He said, the spiritual ignorance of this country will be its undoing.
So I think you should say who this person is so we can actually verify whether what you're saying is true or not.
Okay, it's in the documentary about his life called, his name is Yogananda. Documentary about his life is called Awake. It came out a few years ago, and of course I've read his autobiography, and it didn't cover this subject at all. He left it out. So I didn't know this until recently, but...
So you're saying the problem is spiritual ignorance is the problem, is the root of the problem, the endemic problems of white supremacy, racism, colonialism. Yeah. You're saying right. It's spiritual ignorance.
And it's the problem with the dominant religion in this country, and I'll go to my next quote. A rediscovered gospel has Jesus just about a completely different Jesus from the one portrayed in the New Testament. And he says in this gospel towards the end, I'll be crucified anew by what they do and say in my name. So we've got a dominant religion that's a mixture of the real sayings and a bunch of false stuff thrown in, and when you have that.
Have you ever heard of the distinction between idealism and materialism in philosophy? Because it seems like you're espousing the idea that sort of it's spiritual or ideas that move history, as opposed to the materialist argument, which says actually material interests and forces that move history.
Well, the problem with humans is whether it's a small local issue or a big issue, they tend to twist things rather quickly. And I can give a personal example. My spouse died in September 2nd, a Thursday, and the family showed up 3 days later. I didn't even know they were going to show up, and attacked the house like a whirlwind, turned in a fake will to the funeral home so they could take over all processes, including get the refund for his insurance.
Okay, well, I don't know. I don't want to get anyway, too deep into the weeds of your personal story here.
I'm trying to tell a story and get to the end of it. The problem is humans from greed are prone to lying about stuff.
So you think it's a generic problem of our species, Homo sapiens? There's somehow we're hardwired to
well, our ability to lie accelerates our desire. Our ability to talk accelerates our tendency to lie. I think other species lie, like chimpanzees. They may lie with each other, and I've even seen my dog lie so that he could play. and so it's not a tendency that happens much in other species, but.
Well, deception actually is fairly common, different forms of deception. I think certainly human verbal, I think human self-deception, I think, is a big problem, actually, I think. I mean, that's certainly true. But self-deception towards, I mean, if you were just sort of self-deceiving yourself and you just like were, you know, not really hurting anybody, that'd be different. But self-deception at the level of, you know, having a massive amount of political, military, organizational power, that's a real different thing. So is the problem self-deception, or is the problem these power systems that have been developed that allow people who are either deceiving themselves and or others to cause great havoc, including war, which is actually the main topic of our conversation? I think that's the... So I don't know if deception and self-deception lead to the creation of these power systems. I mean, that's a very complicated argument. Anyway, I certainly agree that deception and self-deception is a big possibly part of what's at the root of the creation of the
original. Greed, yep. Well, hey, one more thing. I was commenting several years ago on YouTube very, very commonly, and maybe not as much as the propagandists helped by Russia, but commenting fairly often on things I was seeing political, and I often criticized Christianity as being one of the problems, and pretty soon I got thrown off YouTube. I wasn't advocating any violence whatsoever on any comment, and that was just criticizing Christianity was enough to get me thrown off.
Okay.
I wasn't being polite, I guess.
Well, and thank you for that. And
well, the point is, I did see commenters use violence in their language, and they were allowed to continue. So, you know, just we've got a system that's not going to fix itself, unfortunately, in my opinion.
Well, that's why I suggest that we need to. Thank you. That's why I suggest we need to resurrect anti-imperialist movement, which never was all that big, but you know. Thoreau, you know, against the Mexican War was, an early anti-imperialist. There's been a few. There's been a few speaking out against the decimation, the wars against the indigenous peoples, westward expansion. There's been there's an anti-slavery movement, which did grow to be fairly large. There's, the war against, the movement against the war in Vietnam turned out to be, fairly powerful, but as a general, total questioning of the United States' basis of power in the world, in terms of its, imposing access to markets through violence, which has been extremely common through our history, hasn't been a widespread phenomenon, certainly, not in the two major parties. So anyway, I think that's a prerequisite for any serious changes going on. So anyway, we got two more callers, Ronald and then Curtis. Go ahead, Ronald, you're on the air.
We lost Ronald.
Oh, we lost Ronald. Let's go to Curtis. Hello?
Hey, hi. So what you're just talking about is, Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote The Grand Chessboard, and in that he outlines basically almost exactly what they're doing in Ukraine, that he feels that American imperialism is good as long as it's American imperialism, and that we should open up these markets to multinational corporations and use the IMF and the WTO for resource extraction, and bring so-called democracy to these areas. So when you read The Grand Chessboard, it's almost exactly what is going on in Ukraine.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know if you heard Democracy Now!'s interview with Alfred McCoy yesterday or the day before, talking about the Russia and China together at last, I believe it is a geopolitical analysis. It was all well and good for the United States when we were the biggest bully on the globe, but now we've got China, and Russia has its own aspirations. Certainly, Putin, as a Soviet man, as a KGB man, certainly hasn't forgotten the days of the Soviet Union when they and the United States were the two superpowers vying for depends on your analysis. They were vying for global supremacy, certainly in different ways. But anyway, that's another conversation. But now we've got China, which has really sort of in the past 20, 30 years really overtaken the productive capacity of the United States, which is what establishing ISIS as a world power. And so, yeah, the McCoy is saying that the possibility of Biden actually had a long conversation recently with Xi Jinping of China was to try to get China to back away from China's strong support for the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the fear that a China-Russia axis could be cemented and could completely shift, and, you know, shifting away from the dollar, as the petrodollars is the basis of, as the base of transactions for the most traded commodity in the world, et cetera, et cetera. It's a, there's some huge things shaking out right now, huh?
Well, but so China did that with our money, with our trade dollars, is how they financed all that, is with exploitative corporations going to China and using cheap labor and low environmental regulations and shipping stuff across the Pacific with cheap fuel, cheap oil. That's how we financed that. And I think that's McCoy that was saying that too.
Right.
In the past, I've heard him say that we financed the whole thing.
Well, sure. But now they're kind of on their own to a lot of extent. They develop their own productive capacity at the extent of the global climate and the ecosystems in China, of course. But so, yeah, I mean, so slavery and colonization set up the United States power, and, you know, so yeah, we've got the legacy of what set things up, but now we've got this, the reality of the power struggles that are going on in the world. And my argument is that we have as United States people in the United States, whether I guess citizens have more of a responsibility, but to the extent that non-citizens feel called to take on the mantle, is that, you know, we are in the heart of our own empire, so we need to, you know, I think here's what I think. I think that, you know, what the best thing that we could do would be to stop. You know, I don't know if it's going to stop U.S. unilateralism and acknowledge the harms that U.S. exceptionalism and unilateralism have caused in the world, and help set the stage. Whether that will, you know, I have serious doubts about the whether you know China is capable of that kind of moral self-reflection themselves, or whether Putin is. I have doubts about that, but we have most control about our own country, and I have even doubts about our ability to influence that too. But,
well, yeah, I totally agree. That's the third thing I wanted to say, was that we need to. The solution is for us to do reparations and microloans and things like that, rather than state-sponsored corporatism and using the CIA to destabilize governments for corporations. We need to go over there and encourage small businesses, and the same thing that we should be doing here, and education and health and education.
Totally, but we still got the I don't know if it's the prime contradiction, which is the, you know, this sort of hardcore sort of, you know, embodied in the Republicans, but also elements of the Democrats, is this hardcore of, you know, frankly, majority white, largely aging people who are still in thrall to whatever the ideology of white supremacy and U.S. exceptionalism, and from the last caller, you know, this kind of Christian nationalism. That there's this, and they're sort of like the Afrikaners, sort of backed into this corner and willing to lie, cheat, and steal and do whatever, and not allow what seems to be, to my eyes, a sort of almost, quote, natural process through demographic shifts, through, you know, so you know, the quote, browning of America, through, you know, young people having, you know, more multicultural, different experiences, not so enthralled to that ideology. There seems to be this general cultural shift in this hardcore sort of Americana, I call it, element, which is preventing that from happening.
Yeah, I think the solution, we should go back to Wall Street, the Occupy Wall Street. It's the banks is the keystone in this whole thing, is the banks. And I just finished the Kim Stanley Robinson, you know, who's a fiction writer, and that's what he advocates is nationalizing the banks, and just, but whatever, turning the banks into credit unions, make them more
Right, but that's a successive step. You first have to have power shifts before you can get, you know, that's a policy change. You're not going to, either you have a coup, you know, a revolution or a coup or whatever, and then you do that, you know, like, you know, Cuba and whatever, you know, nationalized industries, whatever, nationalized the banks. Or, but the kind of power, the kind of policy changes are exactly what's being resisted. So we're not anywhere near the point of being able to make such dramatic policy changes. So we have to engage in the power struggle before we can make those policy changes.
Yeah, we've got institutional investors, or there's success with institutional investors, I think, and also the BDS movement, if that were to take off. I mean, look at the response. Look at how that freaked everybody. It freaked them out, the BDS movement. And but yeah, nationalizing the banks would be, but it's just take your money out of the bank, follow the money is,
well, that's
is something that everyone can do.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, there's the sort of individual level. I think that was one of the better things to come out of the Occupy movement was the challenge to the whole financial structure, and was the call to, you know, take money out of those, you know, Wells Fargo and Bank of America and et cetera, the big ones who are the ones engaging in the investment in the fossil fuel industry and in all the wrong kind of investments, you know, and put them into community banks and credit unions. And I think that actually happened. And but I guess it has its sort of, you know, inherent limits, I guess, the people who are willing to do that or willing to educate themselves, you know, or the ability to spread the word. I mean, that's why, you know, I frankly think that's why Obama clamped down on the Occupy movement, because it was actually starting to gain the kind of traction and success, and his
right.
neoliberal corporate backers didn't want to have that. I mean, I don't have a, you know, a smoking gun evidence of that, but it seems clear that was behind it.
Well, is there any wonder that they want to get off the petrodollar, China and Russia? But
right.
I have a question for you. If I have time, if I haven't taken up too much time, was Putin our man? Like the same way we have dictators in the third worlds that work for us, and then all of a sudden they stop working for us, and then they're deposed. Is Putin like that? Wasn't he our man at the beginning when we extracted all the money from Russia?
Well, the other guy was, who was before Putin, whatever his name.
Was it Yeltsin?
Yeah, for sure. But that's a good question. We'll just leave that hanging. If there's a Russia scholar out there, I barely feel adequate to having a talk show in general, especially when someone throws a question like that at me. But I think it's a key one, and certainly. I'll say this before I let you go, because I have given you definitely more time than I ordinarily give people, but I, you know, occasionally I just kind of like to stretch out with some individual. Anyway, I think certainly Putin was a, you know, I don't know. That's a good question. I think he was more a KGB man than our man, but, you know, I don't know. I think it'd be interesting to, if there was, you know, if someone thinks they have a more inside idea. I think he was more a creation of the pressures of both the, you know, seeing what happened to the breakup of the Soviet Union from neoliberal, you know, U.S. Pressure, a lot of it certainly, and you know, sort of seeing the disintegration, and then just sort of the, you know, sort of going with the tide of what was happening. You know, the oligarchs being created by the you know, the all these huge pools of financial resources from the breakup of state-owned companies, and sort of, you know, the suddenness of the transition in the market economy. I think he was certainly marked by that. He was certainly marked by, you know, his experience as a KGB man. And I think he's an opportunist, but I don't know. I'm talking out of my element. Let's give somebody else a chance and see. We got open lines now. But thank you for Curtis. That was a very enlightening conversation. I'd like to have further enlightening conversations. We only have about 20 minutes left. You're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. We just ended a successful winter membership drive, and we do appreciate everybody. You still can contribute if you didn't take the opportunity then. Go to kboo.fm. And click on that old donate button. I just had all these articles sort of lined up about American hypocrisy about premeditated war, America's Ukraine hypocrisy, list of countries the USA has bombed since the end of World War II. Boy, there's over 20 on that list. The United States of Hypocrisy, revisiting the Monroe Doctrine. That's a very interesting one, especially with the, you know, Russia and Ukraine and the whole legacy of, you know, Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, which was analogous, strictly analogous to the United States sphere of influence in Central and South America and the Caribbean, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, is it time to renounce the Monroe Doctrine? Are we ever going to have a president that's going to do that? Is the U.S. political system inherently incapable of having that kind of enlightened self-criticism? Anyway, these are some of the things I've been thinking about. I could, you know, if no one calls in, I could start reading some of this article, these articles to you to further stimulate the conversation. Here, another article, How Did the United States Create Vladimir Putin? There's one really interesting article. Actually, this is the America's Ukraine Hypocrisy from the Hindu Post, since that comes from somewhere else. Yeah, but 503-231-8187. Again, we did have a number of people called up right away who hadn't called in. Oh, I could talk about tribalism. My first caller, who I suspected was sort of going in that way and sort of a idea of sovereignty that tends to come from the libertarian and right-wing elements of society. And I think the idea of tribalism is something that I have a lot of problems with in terms of the idea of a tribe being what U.S. Native American nations are designated as. And so the whole idea of tribalism sort of being this, I don't know, almost unconscious slur against indigenous peoples, Native Americans, many of whom do still have something of a kinship, tribal structure or society, culture, to a large extent greater than the rest of us. Other ethnic groups do maintain that sort of family-based more than we do, sort of multi-family-based, sort of a intergenerational societal structure more than most of us Euro-Americans. So yeah, I've always had a problem with that tribalism idea. I think it's very simplistic and sort of doesn't take into account that, you know, small face-to-face kinship groups actually were relatively more successful and long-lasting, and I would argue relatively less genocidal in their approach, and certainly less ecocidal in general. Although there's just a lot of discussability there too. But anyway, it looks like we do have another caller, so I'll just stop that, nip that right in the bud. Who do we got up?
Hello.
Okay, Greg, go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was hoping you might have that guy on you had on last week, because he stopped at the important. You stopped the show at the important part. You know why? How we got into this situation?
It's true. It often happens when you try to set up the historical narrative.
Yeah. And I'd like to get back to the war. So
okay.
We overthrew Russia with Yeltsin. And we dismembered the country. We caused the life expectancy to go down by 12 or 13 years in the 90s. We starved the entire Russian population. Okay, Putin got back. He, you know, got in power and started putting together the pieces. You know, he put the oligarchs we made rich in line. Give some money back. You know, they had to donate a bunch of billions to build the facilities for the Sochi Olympics. So we immediately, I'm just learning some of this stuff by some of the stuff I'm hearing, even nobody's mentioning the major problem, which is Sevastopol, the naval base. So we apparently have been in Ukraine ever since that time trying to overthrow the government. And what happened in 04, well, I'm sorry.
14.
I'm sure we were in there in 03 and 04, but in 2014, I'm so disappointed in everybody because Amy was reporting on this. Amy has actually showed some doubts this morning on Democracy Now! About Mariupol, which she should, and we all should, about the reporting that's coming out of there. So what we did in 2014 is they had an election. They elected the Russian-leaning guy. They wanted us to, the U.S. wanted Ukraine to sign this trade agreement with the EU, which included specifically excluding Russia as a trading partner for Ukraine. So we fomented the demonstrations that were out there. The person who was running the show was Victoria Nuland. Your listeners might remember that she had the phone call that was intercepted discussing who they were going to put in power. So
okay, let me just interrupt you there for a second, and then you can continue. But okay, I do have I think there's a lot of truth in the narrative you're putting out. I think saying we did this and we did this it's kind of a reverse unilateralism almost. It's almost saying that, you know, you're sort of glossing over certain contradictions within the Soviet system itself. You're glossing over the fact that, you know, the opposition to, I can't remember the former president of Ukraine's name, the opposition, there's a lot of popular opposition. There's no reason why, of course, the whole idea of regime change is inherently fraught. And the idea that the U.S. should be encouraging, fomenting regime change is abhorrent, you know, because it goes, because he was legitimately elected by all accounts. That's all true. On the other, so it's like, you know, it's like the U.S. often plays this role of being sometimes on the side of quote the right side, in the sense that there was massive opposition to the Ukrainian president, and it did seem to be largely a popular uprising. So I take issue that we actually were unilaterally responsible for fomenting that. We were involved, and we shouldn't have been involved. But I think it's a bit of a simplistic scenario you're painting.
We were in there since the early 90s. We already tried to dismember Poland, but the Polish people fought back when we subverted Solidarity. All your listeners, and you, Paul, you need to read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine book. It's all in there. So what we're doing is getting rich by stealing assets of countries, but not necessarily by war, just by the economic things, the IMF loans, which we cut off from Russia, which is why the population starved and we lowered the life expectancy there. So we've been in Ukraine ever since that time. Had a guy on, strangely, from a strange source, the Sojourner Truth Show, and he was saying we put $5 billion in terms of trying to overthrow Ukraine since the early 90s. This means a lot of media, but also this means that we had the ability to sway the population's opinion. So Victoria Nuland was literally out there in 2014 again, reported extensively on Democracy Now! That her show has really slipped since. And she was out there giving tea and cookies to the demonstrators. So when there was resistance to this demonstration, we armed the Azov Battalion. We got a little bit of crap over it because, you know, they walk around in Nazi uniforms. So we got Israel, the Zionists, to arm them with the latest Zionist weaponry. They overthrew the government and did the physical coup. Okay, then they took the Nazis and they put them out in eastern Ukraine, where they've been fighting the quote-unquote separatists ever since then. So when Putin annexed Crimea, he did this, and it was actually reported at the time, he did this because of the naval base. The naval base is their main warm water port. Putin is not going to give that up. It has the only nuclear deterrence to our power in the oceans with the submarine fleet. Okay? He's not going to give that up. That's why he annexed it. So again, it was reported at the time, but it's completely out of the narrative now. This is the main thing. What we're doing is trying to put short-range missiles that we currently have in Poland and Romania in Ukraine between the Russian, country and that naval base.
Well, let me
what
just...
they're trying to do is get a land corridor between the separatist region, which, by the way, with the Minsk agreements, they were supposed to give them back to Russia, you know, essentially, by making them autonomous. And we have not, we've reneged on that agreement. I'm talking about we, the United States, again, running the country. We want to get the resources that are in the Donbass region.
And so does Putin.
We also want to get Putin so he can't supply his naval base, which again is our major deterrent. It's the only deterrent we have, really, nuclear-wise in the world. This is so important. It is the key to why all this is happening.
Okay. Well, okay? You know, I'm always somewhat at a loss when a caller is much more confident in their and obviously in some ways more well-read about the subject than I am. So I can only say those are all good points. And if anyone has any points to counter them, I welcome them to call in. And I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. And that's all I can say.
DW News, the guy who actually mentioned it one day. Now you'll notice that the maps they're showing have taken out this mysterious area where they're trying to get the land corridor. This is why they're pounding Mariupol to death. So, by the way, we had Mariupol. We had a theater that was allegedly bombed by them with allegedly 1,000 people in the basement. You'll notice that all of them have disappeared. The word coming out is possibly that the Nazis there had bombed the place, were holding the people there. There's reports of the maternity hospital. You may have remembered this one where they bombed this one, and there was 3 people that died, including 1 baby. And I have to mention that just 6 months ago, we abandoned Afghanistan. There are thousands of children starving every day there to death. Nobody wants to mention it. Even the people on our side that talk about other things, they somehow miss this. If you could please get the professor that's at Lewis and Clark that came from Afghanistan, he's an international expert on this subject. Get him on your show and talk about Afghanistan.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Try to understand.
I guess so. We got other few lines open, 503-231-8187. We only got about 6 minutes left in the show. And there's been a very good conversation, very interesting. I guess I'll have to apologize for taking on subjects that I'm really out of my depth in terms of being able to respond intelligently to people like our last caller who is painting a story pretty much opposite to what you're getting in from CNN and other mainstream media. So yeah, we like to get the voices that you don't ordinarily hear. Maybe he could actually write to me to get me that Lewis and Clark professor's name. I meant to ask him that before we left him. But yeah, people can reach me through email. You just go to kboo.fm and go to Wednesday Talk Radio, and you click on my name, and then there's a form to email me. And I know I don't get a lot of emails that way occasionally, but if you wanted to know how to get in touch with me, that's a good way to do it. And I also have a Facebook page, when KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio, which I mainly communicate with my board operator to see what the name is of the person calling in. But you can actually write in your comment or question during, after the show, as you wish. So just go to KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. I can't stand Facebook. Or Meta, you know, but we're all trapped in these technological snares. But it looks like we got another caller to stop me from rambling. Go ahead, Nathaniel, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. This is your anthropologist correspondent.
Oh, I never did get back to you. I'm very sorry about that. But go ahead. We're not going to talk about that,
well,
are we?
I gathered from some things you said on the air that it was a difficult time for you personally, so I'm not personally offended. So I wanted to actually say something about tribe and tribalism, if that's appropriate.
Yeah.
My understanding, I don't know if this is historically correct, but I think our Western ideas about tribe and tribalism come through British colonialism, about particularly about Arabs and tribal peoples of the Northwest, the Indian Empire, the Pathans, people like that. And they're animal herders. I mean, that, or at least that's an important basis of their society. They move the herds around to respond to ecological conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And there's an Arab proverb that some people are aware of that goes, me against my brother, me and my brother against my cousin, me and my brother and my cousin against everybody. And that reflects the politics of those kind of tribal societies that have to be able to split up and come back together again for economic and political purposes. So they can break down into the smallest unit, the household, or they can be a group of closely related men, brothers, or they can be a group of more distant related men, cousins, or they can be all of the, you know, people of whatever group they define themselves. And that's a very materialist philosophy that responds to the fact that they move herds around and the ecological conditions are constantly changing. They live on the grasslands. I think to the extent that we see tribalism in American Indian society, Native American society, are the people who moved out onto the Great Plains when the horses became available to them after the Hopi uprising against the Spanish, I think was the end of the 17th century, I'm not exactly sure. So our Plains Indian culture only lasted for 200-300 years max. And here again are people who depend on horses for transportation, cover large distances, and they don't herd animals, but they hunt herd animals. They hunt the buffalo. So I think that this notion of we stick together and we compete with everybody who's different, which is based on the ecological politics of being horse riding herders, is really the basis of what we now call tribalism. And like I said, I think it came into Western consciousness through the British, who fought with those people all the time and
imposed the colonial system on them, so distorted whatever dynamics were going on
right
before the British got there. The British certainly distorted all social dynamics within and between the different societies that they colonized, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to go back through time and see how people were actually living before colonialism, because it exacerbated whatever competition there was between indigenous societies was certainly exacerbated. Whatever,
right.
You know, so yeah, it's very complex.
You're right. Not only did the British do that, they took their ideas of what a tribe was, what a king was, you know, what a country was, and acted as if the people they were trying to colonize believed those same things themselves.
Right. And then, you know, add to that, so I think that's an interesting idea. Again, I'm out of my depth here. You've obviously studied this more than I have. But so you're saying that there's kind of particular groups who sort of became sort of the exemplars for what we came to know as tribalism. And then that sort of got further distorted to this idea that we use as tribalism now to basically mean any in-groups that are fighting against other in-groups. And sort of that's the so almost seen by a lot of people as sort of almost the way human beings are. But there's a lot of counterexamples. You know, there's like on the Columbia Plateau peoples. I mean, again, it's weird to be white people talking about indigenous people. But
remember that none of those people call themselves tribes.
Right.
That's again,
they just call themselves the people, you know, in their own language. And there is very complex, you know, interrelationships, intermarriage. You know, they came together in large groups at various times of the year. Then they went back to their smaller groups, you know, at other times. And it's right. Just incredible. And, you know, and then there was incredible trading, you know, across regions. You know, there's just goods from the plains that ended up at Celilo Village and from the north.
Right.
Anyway, it's an incredibly rich history. There's been,
and on top of which, I want to add another piece to it, which is when the Europeans started to colonize the east coast of North America and North and South America, the tribes were still moving south, Native Americans were still migrating south and east, and so we displaced Native American societies from the east coast. They started to move west again, and bash into people who are still moving east. And there's a whole long history. I mean, people like people we now call the Crow, the Absarca, they lived someplace, I don't know, around Pennsylvania maybe. And they were pushed by other Indians, Native Americans, who were pushed by white colonists until they wound up in Montana.
Okay, well, Nathaniel, we got to go. We've got a minute left. Thank you for calling. I just want to say that there's Native historians who have done a much more complete job of this. So I would sort of bow to them. I can't name anybody off the top of my head, but that's it for our show. Thank everybody for calling in. Thank everybody for listening. Thank everybody who has contributed and who will contribute, if you haven't already, to KBO.FM. Thanks for listening. Bye. This is Paul Rowan.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:58 a.m.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Show your support for KBOO programming by picking up the special limited edition KBOO Music That Moves You silicone collapsible water bottle. It's the perfect accessory to keep you hydrated while KBOO keeps you moving. Get yours now at